So we rolling?
3, 2, 1, start. So hey, Dad, how's it going?
Hey, things are good. Things are good. This should be fun.
Good deal. So this is the first of our podcasts, and before we get things started here, just wanted to talk about our website, maxwelldrums.com, and then we have our Reverb store, which you should scope out. There's Steve Maxwell Drums - Chicago, then Steve Maxwell Drums - New York. And then, of course, we've got social media, Instagram, at Maxwell Drum Shop Chicagoland, at Maxwell Drum Shop for news from New York store, Facebook. And then we've got Twitter, which is at Maxwell Drum Shop. So, yeah, scope all that stuff out. And to get started here, I'm going to be interviewing a bunch of different people throughout the next, you know, year, next 2 years. We're going to be having all kinds of people, but we started with my dad here, so we're going to kind of talk about where you come from musically, and then this is a lot of stuff that obviously I already know, but we kind of wanted to do this just for you know, for those out there, so to get out of it what they can. So
share the information, and if it's something you enjoy, great.
Yeah.
If not, you can tune out.
for sure. And so basically, yeah, I wanted to start out here with just kind of start at the beginning of your life. So tell me a little bit about how you started, what first got you into music, and then, you know.
Somebody asked me that question today, actually, not you, separately, and it was really funny. I always gravitated toward the drums. I wanted to play them from when I was probably 7 or 8 years old. And I used to play with coffee cans and oatmeal boxes, Quaker oatmeal boxes, coffee cans from Maxwell House Coffee and all that, and put them all together, and I'd play on them with any kind of sticks or straws or whatever. And I just always wanted to do it. So my grandmother talked to my parents and finally bought me a drum set when I was 12. And I just always had an affinity for it. I always had a love for it. And I love listening to music, and I love drums, and I love listening to drummers. So it was just a natural thing from as far back as I can remember. And it's never gone away. I mean, that's it. It's a natural thing from the beginning.
So what was your first kit?
My first real kit was Ludwig Club Date. And people out there who may be familiar with that, there may be people who aren't. Ludwig made great drums, of course. I was 12 years old, so that was 66. And the local music store had a 9x13, a 14x22, Club Date, blue, silver, blue lacquer, nickel hardware, acrylite snare drum, which was their 8-lug aluminum snare drum, and no floor tom, because those kits often didn't come with a floor tom. But I thought it was very cool because it had a cowbell and a wood block, except it wasn't a wood block. It was a cheesy plastic wood block, but that's what they had at the time, and it was cool, supposedly. So that was my first kit, and I bought it because it was the least expensive kit in the store because, you know, my folks didn't have a lot of money. And I used that kit from day one, started gigging with that kit when I was about 13, and had that for quite a while until I got my next one. But that was the first kit.
What were your favorite drums kind of growing up? And then, because I already know, but for everyone else, like what got you into what was the company that you liked the best, and then what got you into it?
Oh, boy, I tell you, those were the days when you got drum catalogs. So you'd go in the music store. I'd go in the music store for my lessons, and you'd see drums set up. And this there was no internet, okay? I mean, I'm almost 68 years old. So there was no internet back in 1966.
Not even
or anything close to it.
So
you go for your lessons, and you go to the music store, and they'd have drums set up, and you'd look at them, and they'd be beautiful, and you'd get catalogs. So I would have the Ludwig catalog, the Slingerland catalog, the Rogers catalog, the Gretsch catalog, Camco, the American brands, because at that point, anything that was coming in from overseas was really horrible stuff. It was just awful stuff. And the really, really good stuff in that period of time was the USA-made stuff, and loved it. So, and Ludwig was always a great American brand. All of those were. So that was the first kit I got was Ludwig, and the first kit I bought with my own money from gigging was another Ludwig, and it was, you know, Gold Sparkle, which I loved, 9x13, 16x16, 14x22, Gold Sparkle kit, beautiful kit, late 60s kit, maple interiors, and it was wonderful. And with that kit, I was able to afford the most expensive snare, so I bought a Super Sensitive, which I regretted later because as much as the Super Sensitive was supposed to be hot stuff, the strainer was a pain in the neck and it wasn't worth it. So
did
I used to go
plastic
back,
part break?
They had plastic parts on it and it was bad. I used to go back and play my Acrolite instead. But anyway, that was the first what I'd call pro-level kit that I ever bought.
And then so Rogers, when you got into that, was that through the catalogs or?
I always loved the Rogers catalog because I always thought the Wood Dynasonic snare drum was an incredible thing, just an absolutely incredible thing. I just looked at it and said, wow, this is so cool, this is so cool. And, you know, they had metal shell dynas, but wood dynas were something I had never even seen. And I thought the Rogers stuff was really, really well made, but the Dynasonic really, really, I loved that drum. And also Louis Belson and Buddy Rich at that time were both Rogers artists in the mid-60s. And were two of my absolute top most favorite heroes on the drums, technically, musically, everything. So, you know, those guys were playing Rogers. It was like, oh, man, great
sure.
stuff. And it is great stuff, and it still is today, as witnessed by my own personal kit right there.
Yeah, this kit's incredible. Scope it out.
It's the only one of its kind. It's basically new old stock. The guy who bought it brand new in 69, never took it out of the house. Two 8x12s, two 14x18 bass drums, 14-14 floor tom, and matching Wood Dynasonic snare, all the original stands, pedals, hardware, everything. And it was originally ordered as a double bass kit because it's even got the little attachment that brings the hi-hat closer to the left side bass drum.
So, which is really cool, actually.
Oh, yeah.
It's lightweight.
It's crazy.
It doesn't get in the way. It's barely even different from a regular stand.
Yeah.
They're still trying to figure out how to make it as good as that one, I think.
Yeah, it's incredible. But I've had a lot of different kits over the years, but the Ludwig was my first... The first real kit I had.
When it comes to making music, tell me about some of the first groups that you played with. Some cool stories.
First group I played with was a group that was, I laugh about it now because I say there was these two old guys, which basically means they were about my age now. It was, we lived in Rhode Island, and there was a heavy influence of Portuguese people in Rhode Island. And these guys used to play weddings. There was a wedding band, and it was a Portuguese wedding band. So the instrumentation was kind of different. There was basically a violin player, a mandolin player, a guitar player, and me. And that was the band. And the guitar player was a young guy, so he was probably maybe 19 at the time. The guy playing the violin at the time was probably 60, and the guy playing the mandolin was probably about late 60s, and he was hard of hearing, so he had to keep leaning over and listen to the mandolin while he was playing it. But we had a great time. We had great fun, and I played with those guys for a couple of years. And then on the side, we always had our little, you know, garage band kind of bands from kids in high school and stuff like that.
Sure.
Kids in junior high and high school, we had that going. But that's where I actually made some money with this little wedding band.
How about some memorable performances that you can tell me about that you were able to witness? Maybe, you know.
Oh, okay. Of other performances.
People that I was never
people.
Lucky enough to be able to see.
Oh,
probably
yeah.
Jazz stuff for the most part.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm a jazz player at heart. So there were several very meaningful things involving different people. I got to see Buddy Rich live many times, which was, to me, amazing. And I was fortunate because those were days when the bands would travel around. They'd play clubs. And so you could go in and basically sit, you know, from here to the drum set there away from Buddy.
Do you have one that really sticks out that you remember?
Well, there was, when I also saw Louis Belson, the one that sticks out the most was at a place called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston, which is a very, very famous jazz club. And one time, I was young, my parents had to bring me there because I couldn't drive. But we went there, and on the bill was Buddy Rich's big band and Louis Belson's big band. So Buddy's band came out and did a set, Louis's band came out and did a set, and then they came out and did a set together. So that was ridiculous. That was crazy. And the other thing I used to do when I was, again, I was about 13 or so, one of my aunts was a big jazz fan, her and her husband. So they would take me to the Newport Jazz Festival, and we would go there, and I got to see what used to be called Drum Workshop, and not from my friends in Oxnard Drum Workshop, but Drum Workshop was an event at Saturday afternoon at the Jazz Festival in Newport Jazz Festival, from noon to 5 p.m., and everybody would come out. I mean, everybody, they would have everybody come out and do 15 minutes. So who would be there? So Art Blakey, Elvin Jones, Buddy Rich, Louis Belson, Joe Morello, Papa Joe, Tony Williams, you know, Philly Joe.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about this
story. On and on. The story goes on and on and on.
I think there's a story you told me where Papa Joe was, if I'm not mistaken, he came out with just a hi-hat.
Oh, Papa Joe was famous for doing that. Come out with the hi-hat and just blow everybody else away. Everybody comes out, they do everything they can in their 15 minutes, and Papa Joe just comes out with the hi-hat and a pair of sticks and just wipes out the whole crowd.
I think he's my favorite drummer of all,
yeah.
Personally.
And it was also the time I saw Joe Morello, the only time I saw Joe Morello live, and I was fortunate to get to know Joe for probably the last 3 or 4 years before he passed. We did a lot of things with Joe, helped him sell a lot of his gear, and I got to know him well. But the first time I ever saw Joe was at Newport Jazz Festival, and I remember as a young player trying to figure out how to do more with my left hand, and as you know, things were working okay, but my left hand needed more work. And I went to the jazz festival, and Joe came out to do his little bit, and Joe would do the little theatrics when he wanted to show off a little bit. So Joe was playing his usual great self. The technique was incredible. And then at one point, he just decides to, with his right hand, reach in his coat pocket for a handkerchief, because it was outside, wipe his forehead from the sweat. Meanwhile, he's doing a press roll around the whole drum set with his left hand, just with his left hand, from the snare drum to the toms to the bass drum. And I remember being blown away by that. And when I met Joe a gazillion years later, I talked to him about that the first time I saw him. And I said, you were doing this at the G. He said, I don't remember that. I said, no. I said, I'm sure you don't. It wasn't a big deal, but it was a really big deal to me, because sure. I couldn't do anything remotely close to that. It was just blew me away. Anyway, those are some of my player stories.
Yeah, all good stuff. Maybe a couple ideas or a couple questions about just your playing. When you were kind of just getting started, how much did you practice? And then what did you, like, what did you practice on? Long was it until you got your first teacher? Tell me a little bit about some of the early years.
I got my first teacher right away in junior high school, and he was the dad of a clarinet player in the junior high school band. He was a really nice guy. His name was Mr. Wood, and he used to sit there, and he had a pipe, and all he did with me for the first year, all we did was play on a practice pad. That's it. That's all we did for a year. But on that practice pad, I learned all the rudiments I needed to learn. I needed to learn what I needed to for stick control and things like that, and how to, you know, balance. On a practice pad, it can be pretty brutal to figure out how to get a nice even balance between your hands and to work those things out. So I credit him with giving me a huge foundation to call from later on in life. That was great. He was a very inspirational teacher. Because he taught me discipline, which was very important. So that made a lot of that had a lot of impact on me, and a lot of other teachers along the way, spanning anything from classical. I studied for a while with Arthur Press from the Boston Symphony for that side of things. I studied with some other people. I studied with just a bunch of really good people that gave me a little bit of a different feel for things. Jazz players, more traditional players, orchestral players. It was good to get a balance. And I did spend time in New York with Papa Joe, and Papa Joe didn't call those lessons, he called those sessions. And it was important because he taught you things. People would ask me, what were the things that he taught you? Show me the brush patterns. And I said, no, it wasn't that. And it was more this. Papa Joe, when I'm young, I go in for my first lesson with Papa Joe, and I've told this story to other people before. You go in for my first lesson with Papa Joe, and, you know, he's this mythical creature, this person who played with Basie. He's got the hi-hat, everything. He's a phenomenal player, tasteful beyond belief. So he says, play for me. So I'm whatever I was. I might have been 17 at the time. So I start, you know, playing every Buddy Rich lick I learned in my whole life, and I'm like going down, and I stop, and he looks at me, and he was a strange little guy too. He's an odd sense of humor and weird little guy, but very cool. And he just looked at me, he just went like this. He went like that, and I don't know what he's talking about. And he does it again, and I said, I don't know what you mean. And he said, you got to breathe. And you know, I went, oh yeah, okay, I get it, because what do we do, right? I'm going to play every lick I just learned, and you go, you get really tense, and you start, and you don't, nothing flows anymore. So he's right. You got to breathe while you play. And he also taught me things like, he said that the drum set, each one of these pieces of the drum set's an instrument by itself. The snare drum, the tom, this tom, the cymbal, the edge of the drum. Papa Joe used to play on with his fingers.
Yeah,
he used to do that. Old Man River, and he'd do a section of Old Man River where he's playing with his fingers on the drums. It's like, yeah. And so every part of each one of those drums, that drum set, is a separate instrument, and you need to use it that way. And he also said, think of the drum set, it's your dance partner. You don't beat up your dance partner. And he said, you dance with it. And he said, okay, I get it. And he also taught me how to pick cymbals. And Peter Erskine and I, it was a funny thing because Peter does the same thing, but not from Papa Joe. But Papa Joe, before he'd pick a cymbal, would take the cymbal, pretend this is the edge of the cymbal, and he would just flick the edge of the cymbal with his finger. And I said, why do you do that? And it was his way of telling whether the cymbal was thin enough to even be worthy of putting a stick on to try it. And the way he would describe it, he'd say, when I flick the edge, and you know, if it's a thin cymbal, he wanted thin cymbals, if you flick that edge is going to vibrate like this. It's going to move, as opposed to a thick cymbal. He said, I flick the edge and say, I want to see all the little devils dancing on the edge. You know? So those were the things that were most important. It was a musical approach to the instrument, thinking about, you know, breathing, thinking about each part of that instrument being an instrument in and of itself and how to use it differently. It was those kinds of things. It wasn't brush patterns and things like that.
Yeah, I remember when I was really young, you told me about the breathing.
Yeah.
And I'm still trying to figure that out, I think. it's really...
And to this day, I still have to catch myself sometimes. I'm trying to do something a little different, and I go, just relax, and it'll work better. But it's a lifelong process. But anyway.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think a lot of the jazz players, maybe of the old days... Yeah, they used to have to play. I've read a lot of things about how musicians were the hours they had to work back in maybe like, you know, like the, yeah, back when jazz music was maybe in a little more demand. You didn't have as much like canned music as you have nowadays.
Yeah. You had live big bands at the theater.
Petrillo, I think he used to call it that. He was like the union guy of Chicago.
Yeah.
And yeah, like so there was a union and musicians got paid really well.
Yeah.
But you had to work your butt off. Oh, yeah. You had to work for hours and hours and hours. And I think that's where a lot of those techniques come from because they had to play for so long that they really had to be loose and because you'd kill yourself.
Yeah, guys were doing several shows a day. If you went to the theater and there was a movie, I'm talking now, this is before my time, I'm talking back in the 40s and into the 50s, but you'd go to a theater and watch a movie, and in between the first movie and the second movie, it'd be like Dizzy Gillespie's big band with Charlie Parker playing in the movie theater.
That's pretty cool.
I mean, you know, stuff like that. And guys were gigging a lot. It wasn't under the best circumstances always, but there was a lot more music, a lot more live music.
I wanted to talk about another thing, kind of moving on chronologically. The family's from Rhode Island.
Yes.
And then just tell me a little bit about, like, you were moving around, gigging a lot, and then the decision to come to Chicago?
Okay, yeah. yeah, so, well, Deb and I got married in 74. So at that point, I was gigging around a lot in town. I was working a lot. Back then, again, work was plentiful. I would be working sometimes five, sometimes six gigs a week, and it was good, and we made good money, and everybody was happy. It was nice. But we had formed a show band and decided to do a circuit. And back, again, we're going back a number of years, back into the 70s. Hotels all across the country used to book in show bands. So we'd have, you know, a five or six, seven-piece band. You'd go in and you'd do X number of shows a night at the hotel lounge. And some of that might be, you might do a show set where it's you know, specific arrangements and things like that done for people to listen to. And then you might take a break, come back, do a dance set so people could do that, and then go back, do another show and that. So we traveled down the road with a show band for, I don't remember how long it was, a year and a half. And it was good. We had some good times, some weird gigs. What else is new? But, you know, there's good gigs and there's strange gigs. The best gig we ever had was playing at the Playboy Club Resort in Great Gorge, New Jersey, which was a great place. It was a beautiful resort out in the middle of nowhere in New Jersey, but it was great. The gig was nice. The room was fabulous. The people were terrific. And then we'd be gigging 2 weeks later at a place called the Wobbly Barn in Killington, Vermont, where there was a 3-inch gap between the barn boards that made up the nightclub that we were playing in. It was about 40 degrees in there. So all sorts of stories all over the place. But
chicken wire?
Close to it. Almost like the Blues Brothers. Almost like I did actually play once in a place with chicken wire. So I know
that's... Did they throw any beers
at you? No, but the chicken wire is real. That's actually real stuff. But we decided to leave the road, and I checked out DePaul University here, and a really wonderful man by the name of Bob Tillis, T-I-L-L-E-S. Bob was a wonderful percussionist.
He did a lot of our local customers have...
Yeah, he did a lot of radio,
Cross
stuff.
Cross paths with him.
pit orchestras. He taught at DePaul University. He was a really wonderful man. So we moved to Chicago. I went to DePaul for a while, and just that was what precipitated our move here.
Yeah, great. So what about the beginnings of Maxwell Drums, the shop where I work now? Tell me a little bit about just kind of how it started, where it started. You know, you're... Because I remember, you know, many people interviewing wouldn't remember this, but I remember when you owned one drum set, and I think it was a Pearl Export kit. It was a black kit. And when I was probably, what, maybe
you
eight?
Were I was pretty young. No, you were younger than that. I have pictures of you.
About Lily's age?
You were about three. I have pictures of you with me.
Yeah, that's
in that
Lily's age. That's my daughter,
bedroom,
by the way.
Extra bedroom that at our house that was I set up as a recording studio. That Pearl kit's in there. That's a true story. I had taken a hiatus from the music business and started working for banks, which ended up being a good thing. I did it for 32 years. But for one period of time, I actually had sold all of my drums, except I kept my cymbals, and that was it. So I had no drum set. And one day
still
I
have those cymbals, I think, right?
Oh, I do, yes. And one day I just decided to go back and play again, and I went to Guitar Center. Much as I hate to say it,
I remember going there with you.
I went to Guitar Center and bought a Pearl Export black 8x12, 9x13, 16x16, 14x22 with the cheap...
The one in Villa Park, probably?
I don't know. It probably was. And the cheap metal snare that came with it. And I had that for a while. And that was the only drum set I owned. So if you start fast-forwarding after a while, I started... that was in the new house, the house we're in now.
It's probably like
before
the 90s,
that,
maybe 90,
yeah,
92,
whenever,
something like that.
30 years, at least 30-some years ago. Before that, I used to collect some vintage drums and try to do restoration work on them in the house that we lived in earlier before you were in the picture. So
you used to bring stuff to Frank's.
I used to do that,
That's
yes.
a cool story. We should talk about that. There's a picture of you in the drum shop. If anyone ever comes to the Maxwell Drum Shop in Glendale Heights, behind the counter, which is you kind of refurbishing, I think it's a WFL snare or something like that.
Yeah, I used to, this is when you could go to pawn shops. Again, no internet, so there's no online anything. You go to pawn shops, and you could buy snare drums there for, you know, $50. So I'd go in there, buy Radio King snare drum for $50, and if the finish was all shot, I'd gently take the finish off if it was not restorable, and I would tongue oil the shell, you know, just to seal the shell, and then I would... go down to Frank's Drum Shop in Chicago, which was run by Maury LaShawn, great guy. And I would say, hey, Maury, you know, can I sell these in the shop? He said, sure, kid, sure.
So was it like a consignment type deal?
Yeah,
or you...
I just put it in there. Huh. And, you know, I spent $50 on it. And, I had to buy heads, and I had to buy maybe tension rods or some other snare wires, whatever. And so I'd sell it in Frank's for like $100.
The snare drum that now would probably sell for $600, $700.
I'd sell it for $100. Maury would take $10.
Even with inflation, that's... Yeah.
Maury would take $10. I'd have $90, and by the time I was done, well, I probably spent about $75, you know, on the thing, but I made $15, and I was happy. You know?
Nice.
But we did that on and off for a while, and some guys... I think one of my drums that was in there sold to Steve Gadd and Chris Parker were in at one point when they were playing a band called Stuff, and they bought one of the drums, and I was like, wow, that's really cool.
So that was kind of a little bit of your introduction to the drum shop, at least being a part of a drum shop, and then it kind of gradually went from there. Back to the Guitar Center thing, I remember going to Guitar Center when you really couldn't get any cymbals that were lightweight at all, and then you used to always go for the UFIPs.
It was the weirdest thing in the world. Guitar Center, for a long time, had UFIP cymbals, UFIP, I call them UFIP, made in Italy, and back in this period of time, these were incredibly wonderful cymbals for jazz players.
We still have some of them.
Yeah. Why they were in Guitar Center, I'll never know, but they were, and this is long before I had a shop. I was friendly with a guy who was the manager of the drum department, and they couldn't sell them. Nobody would buy them because Guitar Center was mostly people playing rock and roll. So I go in and I'd buy all the UFIP cymbals for like 10% over cost because they couldn't get rid of them.
I remember going with you.
Yeah, and they were
wonderful. Show me all the UFIPs.
Yeah. So it was great. But and even before that, my, if you want to talk about inspiration for drum shops, came from when I used to study with Papa Joe. That was at Frank Ippolito's Pro Percussion in New York, which is now long, long, long gone. But Frank ran that business. Al Duffy was the first true custom drum builder, and he was part of Frank Ippolito's shop. So that was very inspirational to me. And then, of course, Maury Lachan with Frank's Drum Shop here in Chicago, very inspirational. And also Charlie Donnelly, who is a name not familiar to too many, but for guys who are my age, they're familiar. Charlie was a great resource in Newington, Connecticut, of all things vintage at a time when, again, no internet, no nothing. You can't find this information out. There were no books. There was no Slingerland book, no Ludwig book, no, none of this stuff existed. You had to talk to real people who knew about it. And so that was, those three people were inspirational for me with the shops. And it was very cool for us to finally open up back in New York City, open up in New York City where we got so much inspiration from in the beginning, that the places in New York City, Frank Ippolito's, Joe Cusatis' place, Barry's place at Drummer's World, you know, there were, all those places were gone, but we went back to New York to reestablish that tradition, and we're still there today. So that, we're
yeah, that
proud
kind
of that.
That was going to be one of my next questions as the, but we should talk a little bit more about the original Illinois shop. So it started out at downtown Chicago. And
started out in the living room.
I guess even before that.
And the very, very first, when the internet was brand new.
Do you remember the first drum set that I ever really got? It was, I'll tell you, it was a Rogers Gold Sparkle 2012-14 with probably a matching power tone. And we used to have the two kits set up in the living room.
Oh, yeah.
And they would be right across from each other, and you kind of taught me a lot. Because, I mean, yeah, you were my first teacher.
Why did we ever get rid of that?
Who knows? I do remember, though, I was kind of a, you know, I was a young, you know, like, what, like 14-year-old, and I really wanted a Pearl kit. So we went to the drum pad.
Yes.
At one
in Palatine,
point.
Which was
in
a,
Palatine,
which was
yeah.
a great drum shop. Yeah. Jim owned the drum pad for many, many, many years, and that was a cool place back then. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
They just closed maybe 4 years ago, something like
more
that.
More than that, maybe. But
it's been a little while, but... But yeah, they and we bought a Pearl kit, and then my first set of cymbals, really, really heavy Sabian. I still have the hi-hats. I think I sold the ride, but I still have the hi-hats that I got then. But and so yeah, but nowadays I probably would have gone with the Rogers, but I wanted something with more toms. Yeah. You know, I mean, every 14-year-old does these days.
Yeah, things change.
That was do you remember what happened with that kit? Do you remember it?
I do remember the kit. I don't remember what happened, but
you probably bought it at the drum show.
I probably did. I have kits that I wish I still had today, and don't know why I sold them. Can't imagine why I would have, but I did. I wasn't using them. I sold them to somebody. Don't remember who I sold them to, but it is what it is. Other new ones always come along, which is the nice part.
I remember, and then you probably had your Rogers White Marine Pearl one at that point. Although that might be even earlier. Who knows what you were playing on at that point?
But you were talking about the drum shop. So I started selling things out of the living room when the internet was new. And this is absolute truth. I used to have to, the guy who did the updates for the web page that I had at the time, you had to email him the updates. And about three or so weeks later, he would update them and this page would be updated. So it was a little archaic. But then it was 2000, God, I don't know, 2000 or 2001, we took a really, really small space in Chicago in the Fine Arts Building.
Where my wife still works, actually.
Your wife still works there.
CYA Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra.
And it was this little 750-square-foot place that was only open on Sundays.
If you're ever in Chicago, check this building out. It's really
a cool place. Very historic building. Historic landmark in Chicago, actually. Fine Arts Building on Michigan Avenue.
They still have manually operated elevators.
Yeah. It's a cool building.
Not so good for shipping, but good for, you know.
And it's an arts-related building. There's all manner history. Of arts operations there. So it's a great place. But we did that. We had a small room there. That was 2000, I guess it was, the year 2000. And then another space became available a year or so later, and we took that little larger space. And then we had that shop for several years.
And if you want to see the original shop, there actually is a video where you can check it out. That guy, what's his name? The guy who came to the drum show. Dick Cully.
We did an event. Yeah. We did an event where we used to, at the Chicago Drum Show, it was fun. We were down at the Fine Arts Building. Every year, Rob Cook sponsors the Chicago Drum Show, which is the largest event of its kind.
And definitely come out to that.
It's really in May. Fun. Always right about the third weekend in May. And it's a wonderful, wonderful event with a bunch of friends we see every year. And at for a couple of years, we did events where we brought people. We rented a couple of school buses and brought people to our shop downtown and had entertainment there. And so one year we had a bunch of different people playing and just a little local group. But one year Peter Erskine was in town, and Peter and his trio came down and actually played that event for us, which was great fun. We had a really, really good time. But that was the Fine Arts Building was where we started. And then
I'll put a link to, if you go to Dick Cully's YouTube page, there's actually a video of this one has Joel Spencer playing. There's a little bit of that. And then it's him playing on Buddy Rich's kit in the original Maxwell Drums, which was on the 9th floor, not the 8th floor.
Yeah.
And it has really cool. Yeah. There's also a walkthrough of the, and it's recorded on VHS.
It was a long time ago.
Bounced over but Joel, that's a cool thing. I'll put a link
for
in
reference.
There for
Joel Spencer's a great, 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 phenomenal player here in the Chicagoland area. And he's just a world-class player and a good friend. And Dick was down in Florida. Dick was very much steeped in the tradition of Buddy Rich. And I happen to have Buddy's last Slingerland Artist kit in the Illinois store. So that was what that video was from. But then, you know, if you followed along after a while, I think it was 2008, when we decided to do something in New York. And the New York thing sort of coincided with Craviato, because I had loved Johnny's work so much, and I got to meet him. And I met him at the Chicago Drum Show. Johnny had made a, this is when the Timeless Timber Drums came out, right around that same period of time, 2000, Johnny had gotten the ability to get this wood that came out of Lake Superior from bird's eye maple, and some wonderful birch logs that had been basically harvested when they were about 600 years old, floated down the river but sunk. And so these were then reclaimed, and this wood was superb, just superb. And Johnny got the rights to use that wood for the percussion industry. So he had made some snares that were being distributed by DW, Craviato, DW, Timeless Timber. And I saw Johnny made a special one, a 4x14, as a giveaway prize for Chicago Drum Show one year. And I went to the show, saw the drum, sheepishly introduced myself to Johnny because I thought the work was just like incredible. And he was so, so kind and so happy to talk. And after the show, I contacted him. I said, would you make some of those for me? I know you're making the 5.5x14s for, you know, for Don at DW, but could you make me, if I ordered like 24x14s, would you make them for me? And he said, sure. So that was the first run of things we did, and I sold those out of my living room.
So this is even before Fine Arts Building.
This is before we actually moved into Fine Arts Building. Absolutely, yeah. And and so I, you know, I started doing those, and that was the beginning of my association with Johnny. So that goes back a long ways to 2000, right about the same time we opened the shop, because we opened the shop in Michigan Avenue right about the same time. But that started that, and then 2008 we opened up in New York, and a big part of that was to create a showroom in the New York area for Craviato, because we just felt so strongly about it. But and also too, because there were kind of no more Purple Drum Shops. Ippolito's was gone. Barry Greenspan was still there. Joe still had his shop, but Joe was Cusatus, but Joe was getting a little older. Joe was approaching 75 years old and wasn't sure he wanted to, you know, sign up for another 5 years of rents in New York City, et cetera. So we went in, and people said, that's really stupid. and we went into New York City.
In New York.
Yeah, in 2008, and then the economy went in the tank shortly thereafter.
That's right when I graduated college.
Yeah. But we did okay, and people say, well, you know, you're the only independent shop in New York City, and I said, yeah, because we're the only ones dumb enough to actually do this.
But our family, yeah.
But thanks to our business partners and the effort of everybody, it's worked out really well. It's still expensive to do business in New York City, no question about it. But there's a you need my philosophy for the shops is a simple one. I don't have a problem with big box stores, but what I don't want to see go away are the independent stores where there's a sense of community, where people can come and meet and talk to each other, where you can touch and feel and see an instrument, where you can come in and get work done. If you've got something broken, you can come in and get advice person to person. You can get lessons. You can just, and some things can be done online. You can do Skype lessons now, and that's all great. That's fine. But there's got to be a place for people to go and interact.
Yeah.
When I was young, if you needed a gig, what you did was you went to the Union Hall. You went downtown. I was in Providence, Rhode Island. You get in your car, you go downtown, you go to the Union Hall, and you walk in, you go, you need a drummer tonight? You need a drummer this week? And it would be like the old exchange, the open outcry exchange markets. Hey, you got this, you need a drummer for tonight, you need a sax player, I got this guy. That's how you got gigs. And there was nothing wrong with it. It worked fine.
Were you part of the union for a while?
Oh, musicians? Yeah. You didn't have to, but you wanted to be part of the musicians union because there were benefits associated with that. And, you know, the union would represent the people and help them, and you want to make sure people got paid fairly for gigs and weren't getting taken advantage of by club owners. So it was good. But that sense of community in the shops is why we want to keep the independent shop model going. Here, New York City, we acquired the Forks Drum Closet shop.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yep, yeah, about now 18 months ago? 20 yeah, months ago.
It's our newest project.
Yeah. And Gary Forkum, who I've known for years and ran that shop beautifully with his wife, family, and great team, decided to retire. So we purchased the shop, and the same thing is true there. It has to be there as a sense of community. We're going to be sponsoring a monthly coffee just to have people come and hang there. And
just if, like you bring coffee and
yeah,
everyone...
we'll bring... And you know, if guys... You've got plenty of famous players in Nashville, whether they're on tour with major acts or if they're guys who are working the studios all the time. But if those guys come in, and we also, this is an open, it's open to anybody. So young people come in, and these are people that can tell them, this is what it takes to be successful in the studio. You have to learn the Nashville numbers system, which is a way of doing charts in Nashville. I mean, these are things people
I've never
need
heard of
to
that
know.
Before.
And this guy's working on the road, and he can say, yeah, here's the pitfalls of going on the road. If you're thinking about going on the road, make sure you know this and this and this and this. So, you know, you need that interaction. And some of it you can do online, but there's nothing like being face-to-face with people and having a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's important. So, you know, we, being in three key markets, being in Chicago, being in New York, being in Nashville, those are three strong music cities, especially Nashville. And New York City and Chicago, too.
Yeah, the per capita in Nashville of musicians to people, I think, is
crazy.
Pretty unbelievable.
And then by the same token, we've also, the other element of this is we've moved the Craviato business now from California to Nashville, which made a lot of sense because it's closer. Since Johnny's passing, we were trying to figure out what to do for the next phase of that. And it makes sense to have it in Nashville. It's closer to natural resources that we need, parts, materials, distribution, customers.
Right.
People, so many people come to Nashville. Craviato is located about 1 mile from the Forks shop. You can go over and see the factory, see how the drums are made.
Yeah, this is going to be seriously cool. I haven't seen it yet, but it's all in the works. And we're going to do another podcast that is pretty much going to focus exclusively on Craviato with you. And then we're also, just so everybody knows, we're going to do one that focuses on vintage drums. And then we're going to do another one that focuses on more modern drums.
Yeah.
So everyone, you know, stay tuned for all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
This one was kind of the, like I said, it was the first one we've ever done. And I think all really interesting stuff.
It'd be fun. And it's fun to do this. And again, we just want to share information with people. If there's some takeaways from this that you like, that's great. Some of the information is historical. Some of the younger generation doesn't even know or isn't even aware of some of the things we're talking about. So there's a little bit of history that you can learn from that. And then when we do something like Craviato, I think we should maybe think about doing that podcast from down there. Do it live from down there.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Which would be great, because then you can actually, you know, do it right there at the facility and people can really see a lot of what goes on there. I think it'd be educational.
I'd love to. It's not too far from Chicago. What is it, like a six-hour drive?
It's 8 hours. It's 1 hour by plane and 8 hours in the car. It's a pleasant drive.
Not too bad. So, anything else you wanted to kind of conclude with here?
No, I think we just, you know, the whole thing for me is it's gone from being something I had a passion for when I was 7 years old. I'm going to be 68 this year, and I still have a passion for it. So my only advice is, if to whatever degree possible, if you can do what you have a passion for, do it.
Yeah. I think that's great advice. Thanks for listening. And that's all.
Thank you, everybody.